Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care, with a focus on patient-centered care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.
Welcome to Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD To The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. Well, I apologize for my scratchy voice today, but today on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we are talking about some of the cool new projects people are working on and about what some of our Indiana food artisans are up to. We'll be talking with Grant Michael of Indy on Deck, who's working on a documentary about our local culinary scene. We'll also hear what's new with food entrepreneur Erin Eds, who has stepped away from Hoosier Mama, the Bloody Mary mix company that she co-founded, to pursue a new food business. And for more on Indiana food artisans, we'll check in with Eric Freeman of the Indiana Artisan Marketplace, which takes place next weekend. And we'll get an update on the Indiana wine business from Jeanette Merritt of the Indiana Wine Grape Council. So stay with us for more on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. So we talk a lot here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio about what's happening on our local restaurant scene, and there is so much happening. New restaurants are opening all the time. So one local culinary scene advocate decided that it was time to document the changes. Grant Michael will be working on a documentary this summer called The Push that will capture what's happening now on the local restaurant scene and how we've gotten here. Now, Grant has also organized some recent culinary competitions through his Indy on Deck website. So I caught up with Grant recently to talk about the competitions, the documentary, and how the whole project came about.
So Indy on Deck was kind of an idea that I had about a year ago. It was a chance for me to help people who don't typically have the chance to be able to see into the food world and see what the chefs are doing and see what life is like on the other side of the kitchen door, on the other side of the pass. And so I thought it would be cool to give people the opportunity to do that. The most recent things that we've done with Indy on Deck are the competition events. We've had two, one at Cerulean and one at Milktooth. Both have gone over really, really well, very popular. So the concept is people pay tickets, and they get to come and actually watch these chefs compete for an hour with a mystery basket right in front of them, right across the counter. And so it's fun to see, the wall kind of torn down between, the back house and the guests, for the chefs and for the guests, because the chefs typically don't see the people that they're cooking for unless they step out in the dining room, which a lot of chefs don't. And also for the guests to actually be able to see a dish come together from start to finish, even the creative part of it, because it's a mystery basket. So that's what Indy on Deck is right now. As a whole, it's kind of an evolving concept, just opening the door for people to see into the lives of the food world, basically.
Well, now tell me about your personal background, because you come from the food world yourself, right?
I do. I worked in a couple restaurants here in Indy and a couple up in Muncie, where I'm from. And then my wife and I found out we were expecting a kiddo and decided it might not be the best move for me to be getting home at 1:30 in the morning every night. So I kind of switched over to food sales this about a year and a half ago, which kind of freed up my evenings, which were typically full of, dinner service. So that gave me a little bit of time to do these other events and write a little bit and take pictures and shoot some video too, which also kind of led into my most recent project, which is a documentary called The Push, kind of about, you know, that the last 15 years in Indianapolis and kind of what catalysts brought, you know, the restaurant world and the food world in general, including, you know, the bars and the farmers and the artisans from 15 years ago and kind of what pushed those concepts to where they are today. And also kind of exploring the growth in town a little bit because, you know, 15 years ago, it was kind of slow going. And now we have 5 to 7 new restaurants that are solid restaurants popping up every year. So just kind of see like what took us from 15 years ago to today and what's going to take us from today to 15 years from now.
So where do you start to try to do that?
At the beginning. So there are still quite a few people that are working in town in the food world that were around 15 years ago and were kind of, raising the bar for food in Indy. So I'm going to start with them and see kind of what their perspective is on how we got from then to now and what the future holds. And then the next move is to talk to some of the younger generation of chefs that are kind of stepping into, you know, their executive roles in the last few years and see where they see the future and kind of, you know, explore a little bit and see if those two viewpoints match up.
So are you going into it with a hypothesis, you know, or do you think about what you expect to find or not?
Yeah. You know, because I'm in food sales, I talk to a lot of different restaurant people all day, every day. And sometimes it's just about what they need to order, but a lot of times it's, you know, about their philosophy on food and, you know, some of their opinions on what's going on in town. And so I think I have a pretty good handle on where this will end up, but my goal is to not put too much of my opinion and my viewpoint into this and really just let it kind of flow organically from, you know, the interviews that I do with the people who are really making it happen.
So what's your background in filmmaking and why are you interested in it?
Well, because of all these conversations that I have every week with all these food people, I've been in Indy for 3.5-4 years now, I think. And so I've had these conversations pretty much since day one. And I've always kind of wished that I had recorded them in some way so that we could look back in 5 or 6 years and kind of see how the city has grown or see what, you know, what we were right about and what we were wrong about. And so this is just kind of, I think, a really approachable way to record that information in a way that's going to be interesting for not only the food people, but also for people who don't typically have a tie to the culinary community too.
So do you think it's the interest is there, you know, enough interest in this sort of thing? It's kind of, you know, inside baseball, you know, it's like, you know, will enough people be interested?
I think so. It's kind of another form of social media almost. It's a way for people to take a peek behind the scenes that's approachable. That's a way that's a form of media that they're used to. And it's going to be fun.
Tell me about your own, you know, personal experience with the film or chronicling stuff and that sort of thing. So it's something you've been interested in?
Well, since I was little, I've pretty much always had a camera in my hand. I remember especially through high school and early college, putting together short videos, mostly with friends, just of pretty much whatever we were doing that day or that weekend. So, you know, I do have quite a bit of, kind of low end experience with editing, but for this project, it's something that I have a passion for, which I think will translate to a really interesting story. Because, you know, filmmaking may not be something that I have a ton of experience in, but storytelling and writing is something that I've been pretty good at over the years. So I think it's going to be a really cool undertaking for me.
So how did you get this all going? So, you know, this was a Kickstarter funded, right?
Yes. We had 30 days to raise $1,700, I believe it was, to film or to purchase a couple pieces of film equipment to kind of raise the quality of the product that we were putting together. So I put it up on Kickstarter maybe a month and a half ago, and it was funded in about 20 days. A lot of the people that donated were from the community, people that, you know, I see a lot, and who are invested in kind of making, you know, the community better.
Is there any pressure there, you know, to, you know, that people have, you know, kicked in money for this, you know, any pressure in there in trying to, you know, come up with a good product?
Absolutely. And I think the timeline of, you know, the couple events that I've done and some other things that I've helped out with over the past few years have kind of, you know, built up trust in some of these people. You know, they trust me to tell a good story and to put together a good end product. And I'm very grateful for the generosity that I was shown through the Kickstarter. It was kind of amazing and humbling. So, you know, there is pressure, but it's more than pressure. It's just exciting to see that, you know, there are other people that are into this, that are excited about seeing this project come together. And, you know, they kind of threw their money on the table to make it happen.
So what's the time frame on it? So you've the Kickstarter funded and you've been able to buy some equipment. So now what happens?
Ball starts rolling in about 2 weeks. Filming will begin. A lot of B-roll just at first until I can kind of tweak the equipment and get everything set up the way that I like and get, you know, the editing ball rolling and kind of get some background film for the interviews. And then most of the interviews will happen over the summer. Just so it's all kind of at the same point in time so that everything kind of lines up. And I'm planning for an October premiere, you know, kind of have a big party. Part of the Kickstarter was if you donated a certain amount, you get a ticket to the event, and multiple tickets if you donated more. So those people have already purchased their tickets, but it'll also be available to the public for, you know, for relatively inexpensive to get in and, you know, get a drink and sit on the lawn or wherever we end up having the premiere and kind of watch this film.
So will the film culminate with something? I mean, is there, you know, do you see a time frame? Are there things you want to include in the film, you know, events that are going to be a part of it?
Yeah, there are a couple important events this summer that I definitely want to hit. Dig In will definitely be a part of this, just because I think it's probably the best, you know, event that pulls the most people in the community together in one day. So that's something that I definitely want to include. And there are other things that will happen over the summer, different dinner events and things like that, that I think should be, you know, that are important enough to include too. So I want to make sure that those get in there. Really, it's going to be kind of a 6 to 7 month snapshot of what's going on here in town this year right now too. I mean, that's going to be the bulk of the film because that's, you know, what's available to us right now. It's hard to go back 15 years in film. So, you know, there will definitely be some things through the summer and early fall that will be included.
Now, can people follow along with the progress and to see, you know, what you're doing and where you're going with this, or to look for information on more events?
Yes, there are two Facebook pages, one just for the film. It's The Push on Facebook. There's also a Twitter account linked to that, too. For most of the information, you can find it on IndianapolisOnDeck.com. Once the filming begins in a couple weeks, I'm going to add another page, or another page will go live on that site to follow the film. You know, it'll be a lot of pictures and also some previewed clips once we get a little bit further along, so people can, you know, kind of follow along with the progress of the film and get excited.
We've been talking with Grant Michael of Indie on Deck and the Push documentary project. For more information, go to IndianapolisOnDeck.com or look for The Push on Facebook. Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health, providing care to nearly 1 million outpatient visitors each year with the mission to advocate, care, teach, and serve at its hospital and inpatient facility and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. Well, the Indianapolis food scene has so many creative entrepreneurs, and Erin Eds has been one of the most successful. You probably know her from Hoosier Mama, the Bloody Mary Mix company that she co-founded. But Erin also launched Country Mouse City Mouse with her sister Katie and sold those products through local stores and farmers markets. Erin also teaches in the culinary program at Ivy Tech, so now she's working on a new business called Dark Horse Deli that will bring a lot of these interests together. I talked with Erin recently about the Dark Horse Deli concept and what we can expect from her new business.
We are really excited to be moving on to some great new projects. Had a great 4-year run with Hoosier Mama, and I'm excited about the future. So the most exciting thing and the most current development is Dark Horse Delicatessen, which is going to be a vegetarian and vegan deli, cafe, market, and catering.
So now we've been seeing a little bit about that online, social media. So tell me a little bit about the concept and how it's going to work, because this is something pretty cool, right?
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. The funny thing is, as I tend to do in life, I put the cart way before the horse and started promoting a concept that I hadn't fully fleshed out before we even really knew what we were doing, and started getting some really nice buzz around it. And as my darling husband Steven said, now you've done it. You have to follow through with it now, otherwise you're going to look silly. So,
but it's a thing now, right?
Yeah, it's absolutely a thing now. Still very much in its infancy, but Dark Horse is going to be a learning kitchen, as well as an educational opportunity. I'm working with some people, some different groups right now, to form strategic partnerships. But the goal is to provide amazing food, phenomenal customer service, awesome retail, and employ culinary students while they are in school, provide them a fair wage and opportunities to learn about how to run and start a business.
So it's a sort of an incubator and sort of a classroom, and then plus a food business.
Yeah, it will have several facets. One of the things I'm most excited about is bringing back the Country Mouse City Mouse retail line.
Oh, now tell me all about that.
Right. So some of you may remember Country Mouse City Mouse. We started it in 2008, my sister and I, and it was a very popular brand for about 3 years. And
now this was at the farmers markets, right?
Farmers markets, green bean delivery, Whole Foods, Good Earth. So we had a nice reach with that. I would love to bring those products back, branded under Dark Horse, and start reintroducing those back into the wholesale market to create a second revenue source for the foundation that this will be.
So culinary students would be working in this and learning how to do it and what all of this takes, and then you would also be bringing the product to the market too.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so much of what we learned in the first few years of doing Country Mouse are things that I would love to help people achieve without the blood, sweat, and tears of figuring it out for themselves. So if there's a way that I can take what I've learned and pass it on to the new generation of artisan food producers, then that would just mean the world to me.
Now tell me a little bit about those days when you were doing Country Mouse City Mouse with some of the products and you know, the excitement that you felt then.
Yeah, it's really funny. We look back and we realize we were very much at the beginning of this entire wave of individual small companies putting their products into the market, especially in Indianapolis. At the time that we started Country Mouse City Mouse, we were one of the only value-add booths at any of the markets we participated in outside of like bread and baked goods. You know, we were making a line of accessory items, condiments, salad dressings, compound butters, you know, packaged in an interesting way and made with, you know, great ingredients. We were also at the very beginning of the gluten-free movement, all of our products were gluten-free, with very little exception. And it was great because that niche was really just starting to get a foothold and people were looking for new and interesting products.
Now tell me when that was and how you started to do that.
It was in 2008, and my sister and I always joked that we would love to be in business together, and the Country Mouse City Mouse name came about when Katie was going to college in Chicago and I was living in Western Washington. So we always said we were the Country Mouse and the City Mouse. Now we're both, you know, living in Broad Ripple and, you know, we're near North Side Mice, but, you know, at the time it was so fitting to our personalities and, you know, our sort of view of the world.
Now, what was it like? Because, you know, it seems like everyone has an idea. Everyone has a food idea. They're gonna launch a business or something like that. What was it like starting that then?
It took a lot of kind of customer education as well as education on the part of groups like the Marion County Health Department. We were one of the first companies that was licensed to work out of a kitchen that we didn't necessarily own. You know, the kitchen we worked out of had the ability to be Board of Health certified, but we had to individually get our own certification. So, you know, they had to learn how to navigate that. The market managers had to figure out how we fit in. And then we had to really, you know, kind of get our customers on board with what we were doing, and it was pretty easy because what we were pushing out was pretty fabulous.
You had some very, very good stuff and very popular items. So are those some things you mentioned bringing some of those back? Those are the things that we could expect maybe to see again?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of our recipes were based on family traditional recipes that either my mother had conceived of or had been kind of in the family repertoire for years. We definitely would be bringing back the Romesco, the Jezebel. I think the compound butters, again, would be phenomenal. Those little push-up containers that they were in are now actually pretty readily available. I spent months sourcing that packaging, and now you can buy them online for 10 cents a piece.
I know, and I remember those. I remember the Butter Boy and the Butter Girl packaging, and it was like, oh my God, how cool is this? Because it was just so, you know, it was so neat, something that you had found, you know, and so I remember those. And so it's those kind of ideas, I think, that people can expect you to bring to this new kind of project. So now tell me how then some of these products will fit in to the new concept, the Dark Horse Deli concept.
Yeah, so with Dark Horse being a, you know, quote-unquote vegetarian deli, it's kind of a contradiction in terms. You know, people have said, how do you have a vegetarian deli? Well, you know, a lot of what you see in delis are bulk items, you know, big bowls of salads and soups and, you know, items that you can buy in bulk to take home or also order, you know, at the counter. It'll be counter service and, you know, sit down and have a great lunch or, you know, early dinner.
So the concept then is, you know, tell me again a little bit about how it fits together, the different components and how it's all going to come together for one concept.
Yeah, so I mean, we will be working out of one kitchen with one of my strategic partners. We will hopefully be doing some college curriculum out of the class or out of the kitchen in entrepreneurship as well as business management. And it will, you know, it'll just give us an opportunity to showcase. And I kind of digress. One of the things that my husband often said to me when I was doing Country Mouse, City Mouse, as well as Hoosier Mama, was that I was constantly giving other people credit. And, you know, you look back at some of my indie style appearances, for instance, and I always had other companies as the focus. You know, here we're making this cocktail, but you know, here's the vodka that I'm using, or who, you know, here's the gin, and that's who make, you know, here's who makes it, and you know, always giving other people, you know, raising other people up around me, because if it was good for them, it was good for our community, and therefore, you know, it was good for me by proxy. And so this is going to give us an opportunity to really showcase those other brands as well. The space will have a heavy retail component where we will sell local and regional craft food items as well as gift items.
So this is we're talking a brick and mortar location, as well as any online component too, or what are you seeing?
Actually, my hope, not so much to have an online store, but Green Bean Delivery was one of our absolute best accounts when we were fully up and running with Country Mouse, and it would mean the world to me to be back on their website, have the Dark Horse products available on their website, with a note on there that says, proceeds from the sale of this product will go to provide culinary education for people that are wanting that.
So now tell me about a little bit about your ideas on the importance of learning this kind of stuff. When someone is a student or when someone is just trying to get that idea going.
Yeah, having the idea, honestly, is the hardest part. Having something that you can prove the viability of is very important. So for this to be a test market for them, for the students that are looking to grow an existing business or start an artisan food company from scratch, there's not a lot of education out there that is specific to a wholesale line. So hopefully, we'd be able to provide some guidance in that department while giving them an opportunity to make and sell their products through us to see if people would like to buy it.
So now, is there... can people find some more information about this or follow your progress somewhere?
Yeah, part of what we did as far as putting the cart before the horse is setting up Facebook and Twitter pages. Coming soon, Dark Horse Delicatessen, which has probably gotten me in some trouble, but that's okay. Twitter is at Dark Horse Deli, and Facebook is the same, facebook.com/Dark Horse Deli.
Do you have a time frame on when we can look for progress?
Well, because this is going to be operating as essentially a nonprofit, the biggest factor right now is finding the people or the organizations to underwrite it. I have to find the financial backing in order to be able to even start looking for a space. Last thing I want is to fall in love with a place and then lose it because I didn't have the backing at that time. So, as soon as I have the right partners in place, I'll be ready to roll.
We've been talking with Erin Eds about her new Dark Horse Deli business. For more information, look for Dark Horse Deli on Twitter and Facebook. Well, as I've said a lot here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we have so many local food artisans. And you can check out a lot of them at next weekend's Indiana Artisan Marketplace at the Indiana State Fairgrounds. I talked with Indiana Artisan Director Eric Freeman about the upcoming event and what type of food artisans we'll find there.
This is our fifth year, and it is an annual showcase designed to highlight the best art and foods coming from Indiana today. So Indiana Artisan year-round juries art and foods and every May and every November. And this is the one time a year when all of those artisans can come together and put their wares and their foods out there and let people come and see exactly what this artisan brand is about.
Now, it's quite extensive, though. It's not just one thing or another, right?
That's right. We define art very broadly. So, jewelry and leatherwork, woodwork, fiber, clay, very broadly. And the same with foods, savories and sweets, chocolates, candies, pierogies, noodles, lots of variety on the food side, too. Wines, too.
So tell me a little bit about the type of foods that will be at the Artisan Marketplace this year.
Well, the marketplace is really designed well. It has five primary aisles. So when you come in the front door, you're looking at five roads you can travel. And the food aisles are the outer roads on the north and south side. It's at the Expo Hall at the State Fairgrounds. So if you go hard left or hard right, you're going to go into a food aisle. And Jolene, purposefully, they are 15-foot aisles as opposed to 10-foot aisles because that's where the crowd is. All of the food artisans provide samples, which is a big draw. So, you know, the wineries are providing samples. But the foods include, you know, cookies from the nuns who own Simply Divine Bakery down in Ferdinand. So cookies, noodles, gosh, jams and jellies, granolas. We also bring up folks from the Kentucky Proud program, obviously in Kentucky.
Now, tell me a little bit about that and why they're a part of the marketplace.
Well, Indiana Artisans started in 2008. Lieutenant Governor Skillman was the one who launched this, and we used Kentucky Crafted, the art program in Kentucky, largely as the model. But Kentucky Proud, the food program in Kentucky, was also somewhat a model. Down there, it's two different organizations. But when the state, when Indiana was looking to create Indiana Artisan, they said, look, let's put them both under one tent. But because Kentucky Proud and Kentucky Crafted were so generous in mentoring Indiana as we launched this 8 years ago, we continue to participate in each other's shows. So Indiana Artisans are welcome at the Kentucky Crafted Market, which happened about 3 weeks ago. It's a much earlier in the year. And then the Kentucky Proud and Kentucky Crafted folks are welcome up here. And every year we have, I'm going to say about 30, 35 altogether, and that'll be the same way this year.
Now, what kind of foods can we expect from Kentucky?
Kentucky, as you know, has its own food culture. So things like bourbon balls, you know, we all know bourbon balls, but we don't really make them in Indiana, but they sure do in Kentucky. Beer, cheese, and then Kentucky is big into sauces, barbecue sauces in particular. There's one artisan that just makes fantastic fudges. I mean, you would call what you would buy a slab of fudge. I mean, and just a wide variety of fudges. Really, really good artisan.
So we'll have the Kentucky segment, but then what's new this year for the Indiana artisans?
Well, we have a lot of new things. There's a cheesemaker up in Rochester, up in Fulton County, who's bringing artisanal cheeses, five different kinds that juried in. We jury in May and November, and so the folks who just juried in November, this will be their first marketplace, and that the artisanal cheesemaker is one. There's a woman in Bloomington that makes wine truffles from Indiana. The wine is from Indiana wineries. And as it turns out, all of those wineries have wine that is already part of the Indiana Artisan brand, so it was a really good fit. So she'll be here this year for the first time with her truffles. We have a couple. Well, there's also a guy from Muncie that makes barbecue sauces. And like I said, you know, Kentucky has barbecue sauce as part of its culture. But we, interestingly enough, Indiana Artisan had no barbecue sauces. And we've had several applicants, but no sauces ever juried in until last November. So he'll be here from Muncie with his sauces. And then we have some longtime artisans that have been with us, gosh, almost from the beginning, since 2008, but have never been able to participate. Lisa Sparks at Lisa's Pie Shop in Atlanta is one. Lisa will be here with her pie and then her infamous pie in a jar. Oh,
now, we have heard a lot over the years about Lisa's pie in a jar. It's a terrific idea.
I've got a funny story, Jolene. The food jury panel is food retailers, restaurateurs, dietitians, chefs, blogger, food bloggers, a lot of different people from the State Board of Health. It's a real varied mix. When Lisa applied, and I don't think this is actually a fine story to tell, that she sent pies and she sent pie in a jar, and the chef, who's a fairly prolific indie chef then and still, was the first to taste it, and then he asked, could I take this home? And then as the day went on, he continued to talk about pie in a jar and said, you know, I could leave this on the front seat of my car for 2 weeks and still want to eat it. It was that good. And I thought, man, there's a testament if ever there was one.
Oh, that's great. And it is a very popular item. You know, when you see her, you know, when you go up to her shop or you see her at other events. Now, what other, are there some others that we could look for?
We have 14 wineries this year, Jolene, that, a record number. I was trying to think, what was the biggest number before? And I think it was 8. So we have so many wineries this year that Indiana Wines is sponsoring the marketplace.
Now why is that? Why do we have so many? Can you see, you know a trend here?
Well, if I had to guess, and it truly would just be a guess, the wineries or a handful of the wineries really do well at the marketplace in terms of sales. Like I say, this is the fifth year, and over the course of the 4 years, a winery has always been among the top three sellers, and a couple of those years has been the top seller. And I think it's because wine in Indiana is good and it's affordable. And when you come to the marketplace, you know, there are items from $3 up to $3,000. But if you want to buy something and take home a bottle of wine or a case of wine is a good buy. And I think that might be why.
Now, so people get to sample all these wines, right? So it's all about the sampling.
It is on the food aisles. Yeah, all about the sampling, which is why they're 15 feet wide. Yeah, because people do just graze their way down. And of course, the artisans often say, you know, they only come in and stay in the food aisles, which is not true. You know, Hoosiers, if they're going to pay $10 to get in the door, they're going to see everything that's there. So, but yeah, you do sample everything. The noodles, as a matter of fact, when you walk in, it is the noodles that you smell.
Is it? Now, tell me a little bit about that, because I kind of remember that from last year.
Yeah, and some of the art artisans don't like that, but I tell you, it's just like going to Grandma's house at Christmas. Judy Coe of Coe's Homemade Noodles in Lynn, way over by Richmond, sells a thick and a thin noodle. And at the marketplace, she brings eight big, I think they're roasters or broasters, I'm not sure. And she makes beef and noodles, chicken noodles, and then a vegan noodle option. And you can sample all of those. And of course, the noodles are dry in the bag. So she has to do it to get you to buy the noodles. And she does very well, too. That smell is a magnet.
So I think that's probably part of what people like, is the fun of that, right?
It is true. And the artisans like it, too. Several have started to refer to this as a family reunion. They come and it's not, I hate it when people refer to it as a show. It really isn't a show. It is very much a showcase of the highest quality art and foods in Indiana today. And those folks like each other and relate well to each other. And so the vibe in the expo hall is always good because they're having fun.
Now, tell me a little bit about the artisan project, you know, how people get into this sort of thing.
We, like I said, we jury twice a year in May and November, and the application is online a good 4 months before it's due. For example, the May application is online right now. Then the jury panels come together, an art jury panel reviews the art, and a food jury panel in a whole different week reviews the food. They go through each application one at a time. Samples are required, both art and food. So even if you make, you know, a marble sculpture in Evansville, yes, you need to bring one of those marble sculptures to Indy where the jury meets. Because there's so many things that can be hidden in slides and with food. I mean, of course, you just have to taste it. So the jury, both jury panels review everything and then make decisions. I'll tell you, over the 7 years that the jury panels have met, 17% of the applications have been successful on average. And so 83% are not. So the bar is very high. And then that's the plan.
Well, now that's interesting because I've wondered all along if everybody gets in.
No. And I tell you, the two worst days of the year for me are the days when I have to say, I'm sorry. Because, you know, I mean, our artists are in love with their work, and that's understandable. And to say your work didn't jury in is really, in some cases, akin to saying, you know, your daughter's ugly. I mean, they really take it personally. And I understand that. I really do. But the goal, the mission of the organization is to identify the highest quality work and then to create a brand that identifies Indiana by its art and its foods. And so, you know, but just by its very nature, we're looking for just the very top tier.
Now, do people apply, can they apply again and like work on, you know, pay attention to the feedback and then get in another time?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I always encourage that because you can apply as many times as you like. And we do provide comments on both the food and the art side. And another funny story, there was a photographer, a woman who applied every jury session. I think it was her eighth application that her work juried in. And I remember we were meeting at Heron, the jury panel was, and I said, you know, if you don't like this work, that's fine, but please be specific as to why, because we need to give her constructive comments because she applies every time. Well, as it turns out, that, you know, any jury on any given day can make a very different decision. And that day they loved the work. So juried in, and after I told her, the applicant, that, she emailed back and said, my husband is a football coach, and he told me you will apply every time until a jury sees the value in this work. And I thought, of course she's the wife of a football coach. I could just see it then. But, every time I didn't see it coming, but I thought, what a great story.
So now, again, tell me how many people or how many artists and artisans will be there, how much it costs, where it's at, that sort of thing.
It's at the State Fairgrounds Expo Hall. And it is Saturday and Sunday, the 28th and 29th of March. It's $10 to get into the marketplace. The State Fairgrounds has a $5 parking fee, so we have to be clear about that. It will involve, I think there are 163 artisans all told. I've been saying more than 150 because that's definitely safe. But now, just this morning, I thought, hey, there's actually more than 160. And about 50 of those are food artisans and the rest are art. And it's all Indiana. I think we have 42 counties represented at the marketplace this year. and plus the artists and the food artisans from Kentucky.
We've been talking with Eric Freeman of the Indiana Artisan Marketplace. For information on the March 28th and 29th event, go to indianaartisan.org. Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health. With its 315-bed hospital and inpatient facilities and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. So next weekend at the Indiana Artisan Marketplace, you can check out and sample from more than a dozen Indiana wineries. So we've been seeing so much growth in the Indiana wine business that it was time to check in with Jeanette Merritt of the Indiana Wine Grape Council for an update.
Well, Indiana has 80 wineries now, and so there's a local winery to almost everyone in the state, no matter where you live, something within at least an hour's or a half an hour drive. When you look at wine for Christmas and the holidays, we always encourage you to buy what you like. If you're a sweet wine drinker, embrace that and drink your sweet wine, something like an Oliver Soft Red or an Easley Reggae Red. You know, those are sweet wines that are very well known in Indiana. But if you're a dry wine drinker, we have plenty of those options as well. Chamberson is a grape that we grow a lot in Indiana. It makes a great dry red wine, a real big and bold red wine that would be a good alternative to your Zinfandels or your Merlots that you might have on your table. So we just encourage people to go to that Indiana winery, ask for those local wines that are made here in Indiana, crafted right here, so you can support the local wine industry along with the local food movement.
Sparkling wines. Talk a little bit about that.
And we have a lot of wineries here in Indiana that do sparkling. Easley Winery in downtown Indianapolis makes a fantastic sparkling wine that's actually made from the Traminette grape. And Traminette is our signature grape here in Indiana, so we have plenty of wineries that make something from a Traminette. Their sparkling has just a touch of sweetness. It is perfect for, not only that New Year's celebration, but any meal that you want to pair it with. It goes good with orange juice, too, in the morning if you want to do something like that. So a fun sparkling there. Oliver Winery, Huber Winery down in southern Indiana makes some great sparkling options as well. So there's a lot of local sparkling wines that you can purchase for that celebration.
And sparklers go really well with food, right? So maybe we can talk about a little bit about some pairing ideas.
I think champagne and Indiana sparkling wine are some of the best food pairing options because they just go so well with anything. If you look at pork, if you're looking at the ham, that's a great option for any type of a pork dish. If you're looking at beef, I think, even a pink sparkling can really go well with a nice roast beef. So it tends to be a very versatile wine that can pair with a lot of foods very well.
Now, what about some other wines that people might not be as familiar with? We've heard a little bit about the Traminette, and so I think people are starting to realize that is indeed Indiana's signature wine. Talk a little bit about Traminette and then some others that we probably should be looking for.
Traminette has become very popular. Back in 2009, with the help of the Department of Agriculture, we at the Purdue Wine Grape Team launched Traminette as our signature grape and signature wine in the state. With that, wineries and our vineyards are planting so much more of the grape. Wineries are selling out of it every time they put it on the shelf because there's so much recognition for the product now. And it can be made anywhere from a semi-dry to a semi-sweet. Of course, I said there's a few that are making it into a sparkling. So there's a lot of options for Traminette and just a great wine. Somebody who likes a Gewurztraminer is going to like Traminette because it's very similar to that. When we look at other grapes we grow here in the state, something like a Chamberson that I mentioned, a great dry red. It makes a fantastic rosé for those who like the pink wines. A drier rosé, it's a wonderful option for either of those. We have Vignole, that's a great white wine, typically made anywhere from dry to just a touch of sugar in it. We have things like Chardonnay. For those who like Chardonnay, the Chardonnay grape is a hybrid between a Chardonnay and a Sauvignon Blanc. So if you like the styles of those wines, you can probably guess that Chardonnay is going to have those types of characteristics in it as well. So a lot of grapes grow here in Indiana, and we do a lot of work with all of them.
I think that's interesting. I think people probably aren't as aware of the fact that the grapes are growing here in Indiana. They're not just our wineries aren't just buying juice from other states, other places, and then making the wine, but they're also growing it.
It is a corn and soybean state as you drive across Indiana. We've got a lot of crops and critters all around the state, but we can still grow grapes. We have about 700 acres of grapes in Indiana, so by no means are we near the size of the West Coast, but we do have lovely vineyards all around the state. When we want to plant or when we want to make a wine with Chardonnay or Zinfandel, then we likely have to go to the West Coast to source those because they just don't grow very well here in the state. So we'll bring those grapes in from the West Coast or maybe from South America to make some of those different styles of wine. But we can make an awful lot of wines here from the grapes that we grow in the Hoosier State.
Tell me a little bit about the buying options and how you know, of course, we are hearing a lot about Sunday sales, but you can already buy wine at the wineries, right?
You can. You can't go into a liquor store and buy alcohol on a Sunday, and I spend a lot of times on the weekends encouraging people to visit those wineries when it's Sunday evening and you wish you would have that bottle of wine to go with whatever event you're having, to remind them that, you know, take the trip down the road. The wineries sell wine on Sundays. You can go in for a tasting. You can do carry out at wineries on Sundays. Of course, we have very good distribution of some of our wines around the state. So you can find Indiana wine on store shelves, maybe not as much as what I would wish. I'd love to see more shelf space dedicated to Indiana wines. But we have you know, some of the bigger wineries you can find in the Krogers and the Marshes of the world and your CVS, you know, your local drugstores as well. So there is Indiana wine on those products. Shipping remains an issue. You can't call the winery today and have the wine shipped to you tomorrow. Unless you have visited the winery first and signed a shipping form where they can verify that you are indeed 21 years of age, and then you can buy the wine, and then you can go home, and when you decide you're out, and you can call and have them ship some to you.
So that might not be a bad idea to do when you're visiting a winery, you know, if you have your favorites in Indiana, to go ahead and get that done ahead of time so that you could then have it shipped later.
I encourage people, when you go to the winery, if you think you're going to want this, be sure to sign the shipping form. Or if you go to a festival or an event where there's multiple wineries, ask them for their shipping forms. A lot of them will have them ready for you. But, you know, sign a whole bunch of them while you're with 20 or so wineries. So when you get home and you taste that wine and you realize you're going to want more, you're able to get it much more easily.
What do you, as a wine person, look forward to?
Well, 2015 is going to be a great year for our industry. I have a list of 20 potential wineries that could open, maybe not just in 2015, but in the next 2 or 3 years. I have about 40 more who are interested, who've shown interest at some point. So our industry could push 100 wineries here in the next couple of years. And we have such quality wineries in the state. We may not number into the thousands and thousands like some of the folks on the West Coast, but we have quality people. We have wineries that are winning major international awards and wonderful wine competitions. And so it's always fun to see the new folks come on board and see just how well that they are embraced. Of course, the Vintage Indiana Festival will be the first Saturday in June. That's June 6th. It'll be in its 16th year. We are one of the most established festivals now in the city of Indianapolis, and people just turn out for this in droves. So I love this event. Of course, I put it on, so it's a fantastic day. It's fun for people to come in and learn about the 25 or 30 wineries who come and attend and enjoy their products. So I think 2015 will be a banner year for us.
So tell me just a little bit more about the number of wineries that we do have. Those are some impressive figures. Why are people opening up so much?
We are nearly at 80 wineries. We have very little turnover in our industry. We don't tend to lose very many people. If we do, it's, you know, due to a death and somebody just can't carry it on. But we continue to see folks who want to get involved. It may be that they went to California and tried some great wine, or they visited other Indiana wineries and tried great wine and decided this is what they want to spend retirement doing. We have people that are coming out of college, and maybe they're inheriting 5 or so acres of ground from Grandpa's farm where you can't plant row crops on 5 acres and make a living, but you can plant grapes and build a winery and make a living doing that. And of course, demand really encourages so much growth because as we see wineries around the state selling so much product and doing so well, there is a demand for local wine, and that encourages and people to open up their winery as well.
Now, what are some of the newest wineries that we might not be aware of? You know, we know the big names, mm-hmm. you know, that we look for and that we see in the stores. Are there some little ones we should be checking out?
A couple of our newer ones that have actually done very well in some of our competitions. Tunney Winery is in Muncie, and they've only been open 5 years, so still fairly new compared to some of our older folks. But this year in our Indy International Wine Competition, which brings in wine from 40 states and 15 countries, they won Indiana's Winningest Winery Award, beating wineries that have been around for many, many more years. And, you know, they were just floored by that. And so when we see our new wineries open and do so well, you know, people flock to them, obviously, and they want to go visit them. So Tunney is in Muncie. So if you're planning that trip to Ball State, they're a great stop. Blackhawk Winery is in Sheridan, so just a little bit north of Indianapolis. They have been open since the spring and making exceptional wine. It's a very country feel. The winery is on their home property. They've got some goats and sheep out back as well, along with their vineyard. And you really feel like you're heading out to the farm when you go and visit them. And so they're a fun stop and making really great wine. If you travel down into southern Indiana, we've got places like Quibble Hill, Mystique Winery that are in Salt Creek Winery, some smaller folks that are, you know, doing very well in the process. So we just continue to see folks open and open up all around the state and put dots on our maps.
Now, tell me just a little bit about the Indy International Wine Competition, because that is a big deal in the wine world, right?
It is. It is one of the largest wine competitions in the country. We only place second to a few that are in California. We bring in nearly 3,000 wines from all around the world. So 14 countries, nearly 40 states enter the competition, and you know we get rice wine, we get port from Portugal. I mean, we get some big name, high end, nice champagnes from France that are just fantastic. And then we have nearly half of our wineries from Indiana who will enter. When we do the competition, all the wines are judged by wine educators, wine writers, wine makers, you know, people who really know wine and who understand wine from all parts of the country, who can understand a good elderberry wine and a really good Cabernet Sauvignon. So they have to have a wide breadth of knowledge in the industry. The wines are all presented to our judges in numbered glasses. They have no idea where the wine comes from. They have no idea if it's from Kansas or Indiana or New York or France. And so, you know, and they are giving it medals. And the ones that rise to the top end up in our best of show. And then we give out some really huge trophies. And it's always fun to travel, not only in Indiana but other parts of the country, and see those trophies displayed very proudly at the wineries.
We've been talking with Jeanette Merritt of the Indiana Wine Grape Council. For more information on local wineries, tours, and events, go to indianawines.org. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. I'd like to thank our guests this week, Grant Michael from Indie on Deck and the Push Documentary Project, Aaron Eds of Dark Horse Deli, Eric Freeman of the Indiana Artisan Marketplace, and Jeanette Merritt of the Indiana Wine Grape Council. And thanks to John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio.